As the games begin, sports writers kill me for skipping the opening ceremonies. Perry kills me for it, too. But I'm not in Atlanta for opening ceremonies. I'm here for gold, and I need to hoard what little concentration and energy I can muster these days. The tennis is being played in Stone Mountain, an hour's drive from the opening ceremonies downtown. Stand around in the Georgia heat and humidity, wearing a coat and tie, waiting for hours to walk around the track, then drive to Stone Mountain and give my best? No, I can't. I'd love to experience the pageantry, to savor the spectacle of the Olympics, but not before my first match. This, I tell myself, is focus. This is what it means to put substance above image. With a good night's sleep under my belt, I win my first rounder against Jonas Björkman from Sweden. In the second round, I cruise past Karol Kučera from Slovakia. In the third round, I face a stiffer test from Andre Gaudenzi from Italy. He has a muscle-bound game. He likes to trade body blows, and if you respect him too much, he gets more macho. I don't show him any respect, but the ball doesn't respect me. I'm making all sorts of unforced errors. Before I know what's happening, I'm down a set and a break. I look to Brad. What should I do? He yells, "Stop missing!" Oh, right. Sage advice. I stop missing, stop trying to hit winners, put the pressure back on Gaudenzi. It's really that simple, and I scrape out an ugly, satisfying win. In the quarters, I'm on the verge of elimination against Ferreira. He's up 5-4 in the third, serving for the match. But he's never beaten me before, and I know exactly what's going on inside his body. Something my father used to say comes back to me.
If you stick a piece of charcoal up his ass, you'll pull out a diamond.
Round, Tiffany cut. I know Ferreira's sphincter is squeezing shut, and this makes me confident. I rally, break him, win the match. In the semis, I meet Leander Pays from India. He's a flying jumping bean, a bundle of hyperkinetic energy, with the tour's quickest hands. Still, he's never learned to hit a tennis ball. He hits off-speed, hacks, chips, lobs. He's the Brad of Bombay. Then, behind all his junk, he flies to the net and covers so well that it all seems to work. After an hour, you feel as if he hasn't hit one ball cleanly, and yet he's beating you soundly. Because I'm prepared, I stay patient, stay calm, and beat Pays 7-6, 6-3. In the final, I play Sergei Bruguera from Spain. The match is delayed by thunderstorms, and the forecasters say it will be 5 hours before we can get on the court. So I wolf down a spicy chicken sandwich from Wendy's. Comfort food. On the day of a match, I don't worry about calories and nutrition. I worry about having energy and feeling full. Also, because of my nerves, it's rare that I'm hungry on match day, so any time I have an appetite, I try to capitalize. I give my stomach whatever it asks for. Swallowing the last bite of spicy chicken, however, the clouds part, the storm blows away, and the heat comes. Now I have a spicy chicken sandwich sitting on my gut. It's 90 degrees, and the air is as thick as gravy. I can't move. And I have to play for a gold medal? So much for comfort food. I'm in extreme gastric discomfort. But I don't care. Gil asks how I feel, and I tell him, A-okay. I'm gonna hustle for every ball. I'm gonna make this guy run. And if he thinks he's taking this medal back to Spain, he's got another think coming. Gil grins from ear to ear.
That's my boy.
It's one of the rare times, Gil says, that he sees no fear in my eyes as I walk onto the court. From the opening serve, I'm pounding Bruguera, moving him from corner to corner, making him cover a parcel of real estate the size of Barcelona. Every point is a blow to his midsection. In the middle of the second, we have a titanic rally. He wins the point to get back to deuce. He takes so much time getting ready for the next point that I could argue with the umpire. By rights, I should argue, and Bruguera should get a warning. Instead, I use the moment to wander over to the ball boy, grab a towel, whisper to Gil, "How's our friend looking over there?" Gil smiles. He nearly laughs, except that Gil never laughs during a fight. Even though Bruguera has won the point, Gil sees, and I see, that winning the point will cost him the next 6 games. Gil shouts, "That's my boy!" As I mount the review stand, I think, what will this feel like? I've watched this on TV so many times, can it possibly live up to my expectations? Or, like so many things, will it fall short? I look left and right. Pays, the bronze winner, is on one side. Bruguera, the silver winner, is on the other. My platform is a foot higher, one of the few times I'm taller than my opponents. But I'd feel 10 feet tall on any surface. A man drapes the gold medal around my neck. The national anthem starts. I feel my heart swell, and it has nothing to do with tennis or me, and thus it exceeds all my expectations. I scan the crowd and spot Gil, Brooke, Brad. I look for my father, but he's hiding. He told me the night before that I've managed to reclaim something taken from him years ago, and yet he doesn't want to be visible, doesn't want to detract from the specialness of my moment. He doesn't understand that this moment is special precisely because it's not mine. Days later, for reasons I can't begin to comprehend, the Olympic afterglow is gone. I'm on the court in Cincinnati, losing my mind. Playing for myself again, I'm smashing my racket in a fit of rage. I go on to win the tournament, however, which seems laughable, and only aggravates my sense that it's all a joke. Then, in August, at the RCA Championships in Indianapolis, playing a first-round match against Daniel Nestor, a Serb from Canada, I'm well ahead. But I feel unduly piqued that he's just broken my serve. I can't let go of my sudden anger. I look up at the sky and fantasize about flying away. Since I can't fly away, at least the tennis ball can fly away. Be free, little ball. I whack it high above the stands and out of the stadium. Automatic warning. The umpire, Dana Leconto, says into the microphone, "Code violation. Warning. Abuse of ball." "Fuck you, Dana," he calls over the ref. He tells the ref that Agassi said, "Fuck you, Dana." The referee approaches and asks, "Did you say that?" "Yes." This match is over. "Fine. Fuck you, too. And fuck the umpire you rode in on." The fans start a riot. They don't understand what's happening because they can't hear me. They only know that they paid to see a match and now it's being canceled. They're booing, firing seat cushions and water bottles onto the court. The mascot of the RCA Championships is a Spuds McKenzie dog, which now trots onto the court, dodging seat cushions and water bottles. He reaches the middle of the net, lifts his hind leg, and pees. I couldn't agree more. He makes a jaunty exit. I'm right behind him, ducking my head, dragging my tennis bag. The crowd is going berserk, like the crowd in a gladiator movie. They're showering the court with garbage. In the locker room, Brad says, "What the..." "They defaulted me." "Why?" I tell him. He shakes his head. His 7-year-old son, Zach, is crying because the people are being mean to Uncle Andre, and because Spuds McKenzie peed on the net. I send them both away, then sit in the locker room for an hour, head bowed. So, here we are, a new low. Fine, I can handle this. I can actually get comfortable here. I can settle in. Rock bottom can be very cozy, because at least you're at rest. You know you're not going anywhere for a while. But rock bottom is still a ways down. I go to the 1996 U.S. Open, and right away there's controversy. Something about seeding. A few of my fellow players complain that I've gotten special treatment, that I was bumped up in the draw because tournament officials and CBS want to see me and Pete in the final. Mooster says I'm a prima donna. I take particular glee, therefore, in knocking his hair-mussing ass out of the quarters, continuing to keep my promise that I would never lose to him again. I reach the semis against Chang. I can't wait to put a beating on him after losing to him months ago at Indian Wells. It should be no problem. He's on the back nine of his career, Brad says. So am I, people say. But I have a gold medal. I almost wish I could wear it during the match. Chang, however, doesn't give a damn about my gold medal. He fires 16 aces, wriggles out of 3 break points, forces me into 45 unforced errors. 7 years after winning his last slam, Chang is almighty, omnipotent. He is risen, and I am fallen. The next morning, sports writers trash me. I quit, I tanked, I didn't care. It almost seems as if they're angry with me, and I know why. As a result of my loss, they now have to deal with Chang for one more day. I don't watch the final on TV when Pete beats Chang in straight sets, but I do read about it. Every article says matter-of-factly that Pete is the best player of his generation. As the year winds down, I go to Munich, where the boos are deafening. I lose to Mark Woodford, whom I beat 6-0, 6-0 2 years ago. Brad is apoplectic. He begs me to tell him what's wrong. I don't know.
Tell me, man, tell me.
I would if I could. We agree that I should rest, pull out of the Australian Open.
Go home, he says. Get some rest. Spend some time with your fiancé. That'll cure whatever ails you.
Chapter 20. Brooke and I buy a house in Pacific Palisades. It's not the house I wanted. I had my heart set on a big rambling farmhouse with a family room off the kitchen. But she loved this one, so here we are, living in a multi-level French country knockoff set against the side of a cliff. It has no flow, and it feels sterile. The ideal house for a childless couple who plan to spend lots of time in different rooms. The real estate agent gushed about the breathtaking views of the skyline. In the foreground is Sunset Boulevard. At night, I can see the Holiday Inn where I stayed after our first date. Many nights I stare at the hotel and wonder what would have happened if I'd kept driving, if I'd never phoned Brooke again. I decide that the view from our new house is better when fog or smog prevents me from seeing that Holiday Inn. At the close of 1996, we throw a combination housewarming New Year's Eve party, invite the gang from Vegas and Brooke's Hollywood friends. We confer with Gil about security. After a new batch of scary letters, we have to guard against intruders, so Gil spends most of the night standing at the foot of the driveway, screening people as they arrive. McEnroe shows up, and I kid him about getting past Gil. He sits on the deck, talking tennis, my least favorite topic these days, so I drift in and out. I spend the night mixing margaritas, watching JP slap his drums with a steel Buddy Rich-type brush, and sitting before the fireplace. I stoke it, feed it, stare deep into the flames. I tell myself that 1997 is going to be better than 1996. I vow that 1997 is going to be my year. Brooke and I are at the Golden Globe Awards when I get a call from Gil. His 12-year-old daughter, Casey, has been in an accident. She was snow sledding on a church trip at Mount Charleston, an hour north of Vegas, and went straight into a frozen snowbank. She broke her neck. I leave Brooke and fly to Vegas, arriving at the hospital in my tuxedo. I find Gil and Gay in the hallway, looking as if they're barely hanging on. We hug, and they tell me it's bad, very bad. Casey's going to need surgery. Doctors say there's a chance she'll be paralyzed. We spend days at the hospital, talking to doctors, trying to keep Casey comfortable. Gil needs to go home, get some sleep. He's out on his feet, but he won't leave. He's going to stand guard over his daughter. I get an idea. I have a big, pimped-out minivan, which I bought from Perry's father. It has a satellite dish and a fold-out bed. I park it right outside the hospital, outside the front door, and I tell Gil, "Now, when visiting hours are over, you don't have to go home. You can just go downstairs and catch a few hours shut-eye in the back of your new van. And since it's all metered parking in front of the hospital, I've filled the van's cup holders with quarters." Gil gives me a strange look, and I realize it's the first time that he and I have ever switched roles. For a few days, it's me making him stronger. When the hospital releases Casey a week later, the doctors say she's out of the woods. Her surgery was a success, and she'll be up and around in no time. Still, I want to follow her home, stick around Vegas, see how she recovers. Gil won't hear of it. He knows I'm due in San Jose. I tell Gil I'm going to pull out of the tournament. "Absolutely not," he says. "There's nothing to do now but wait and pray. I'll phone you with updates. Go. Play." I've never had an argument with Gil, and I won't let this be the first. Reluctantly, I go to San Jose and play my first match in 3 months. I face Mark Knowles, one of my old roommates at the Bolotari Academy. After a solid doubles career, he's trying to break into the singles bracket. He's a great athlete, but I shouldn't have any trouble with him. I know his game better than he knows it himself. And yet, he takes me to a third set. Even though I win, it's not an easy win, so it sticks in my craw. I hack my way through the tournament, seemingly on a collision course with Pete. But I falter in the semis against Greg Rusedski from Canada. My mind hurries back to Vegas, hours ahead of my body. I'm at the bachelor pad, watching TV with Slim, my assistant. I'm in a bad way. Casey isn't doing well, and the doctors don't know why. Gil is on the brink. Meanwhile, my wedding looms. I think all the time about postponing it, or calling it off altogether, but I don't know how. Slim is stressed, too. He was with his girlfriend recently, he says, and the condom broke. Now she's late. During a commercial, he stands up and announces that there's only one thing to do. Get high. He says, "You want to get high with me?" "High?" "Yeah." "On what?" "Gak." "What the hell's gak?" "Crystal meth." "Why do they call it gak?" "Because that's the sound you make when you're high. Your mind is going so fast, all you can say is gak, gak, gak." That's how I feel all the time. What's the point? Makes you feel like Superman, dude, I'm telling you. As if they're coming out of someone else's mouth, someone standing directly behind me, I hear these words. "You know what? Fuck it. Yeah. Let's get high." Slim dumps a small pile of powder on the coffee table. He cuts it, snorts it. He cuts it again. I snort some. I ease back on the couch and consider the Rubicon I've just crossed. There is a moment of regret, followed by vast sadness. Then comes a tidal wave of euphoria that sweeps away every negative thought in my head, every negative thought I've ever had. It's a cortisone shot to the subcortex. I've never felt so alive, so hopeful, and above all, I've never felt such energy. I'm seized by an urge, a desperate desire to clean. I go tearing around my house, cleaning it from top to bottom. I dust the furniture. I scour the tub. I make the beds. I sweep the floors. When there's nothing left to clean, I do laundry. All the laundry. I fold every sweater and t-shirt, and still I haven't made a dent in my energy. I don't want to sit down. If I had table silver, I'd polish it. If I had leather shoes, I'd shine them. If I had a giant jug of coins, I'd roll them into paper wrappers. I look high and low for Slim. He's out in the garage, taking apart the engine of his car and putting it together again. I tell him I could do anything right now. Anything, man, anything, anything, any fucking thing. I could get in the car and drive to Palm Springs and play 18 holes, then drive home and make lunch and go for a swim. I don't sleep for 2 days. When I finally do, it's the sleep of the dead and the innocent. Playing weeks later, I struggle against Scott Draper. Left-handed, talented, he's a good player, but I've beaten him soundly in the past. I shouldn't have any trouble with him, and yet he's cleaning my clock. I'm so far from being able to beat Draper, in fact, I honestly wonder if it was me who beat him the last time. How could I have been that much better such a short time ago? He's outplaying me in every phase of the game. Afterward, reporters ask if I'm okay. They don't sound accusatory or mean. They sound like Perry and Brad. They're actually concerned, trying to figure out what's wrong. Brooke is remarkably unconcerned. I lose all the time now, and the only time I don't lose is when I pull out of a tournament, and her only comment is that she enjoys having me around more. Also, since I'm generally playing less often, she says I'm not as moody. Her oblivion is partly due to the wedding planning, but also her rigorous premarital training regimen. She's working with Gil to get in shape for that white dress. She's running, lifting, stretching, counting every calorie. For added motivation, she tapes a photo on the refrigerator door, and around the photo, she puts a magnetic heart frame. It's a photo of the perfect woman, she says. The perfect woman with the perfect legs. The legs Brooke wants. Astonished, I stare at the photo. I reach out and touch the frame. Is that? Yep, Brooke says. Steffi Graf. I play Davis Cup in April, looking for a spark. I practice hard, train hard. We're up against the Netherlands. My first match in Newport Beach is against Cheng Schalken. He's 6'5", but serves like a man 5'6". Still, he strikes the ball cleanly, and like me, he's a punisher. A baseliner who stays back and tries to run an opponent into the ground. I know what I'm in for. The day is sunny, windy, and weird. Dutch fans wear wooden shoes and wave tulips. I beat Schalken in 3 weary sets. 2 days later, I play Jan Siemerink, a.k.a. the Garbage Man. He's a lefty, an excellent volleyer, who gets to the net quick and covers it well. But that's the only part of his game that isn't comically, fundamentally unsound. Every Siemerink forehand looks mishit. Every backhand seems shanked. Even his serve has a wacky, slingy quality. Garbage. I start the match confident, then recall that his lack of form is a powerful weapon. His abysmal shot-making keeps you always off balance. Your timing never feels right. After 2 hours, I'm wrong-footed, breathing hard, and have a splitting headache. I'm also down 2 sets to love. Still, somehow, I win, making me 24-4 in Davis Cup play, one of the best records ever compiled by an American. Sports writers praise this small part of my game and ask why I can't translate it to the rest of my game. Even if their praise is tempered, I bask in it. It feels good. I give a small thanks for Davis Cup. On the other hand, Davis Cup plays havoc with my manicure schedule. Brooke has made many requests of me for the wedding, but her non-negotiable demand is that my nails be perfect. I pick at my cuticles, a lifelong nervous habit, and when she puts a wedding band on my finger, she says, she wants my hands looking their best. Just before my match with the garbage man, and again after the match, I submit. I sit myself in the manicurist's chair, watch the woman work at my cuticles, and tell myself this feels as off-balance and wrong-footed as my match against the garbage man. I think, now this is what I call garbage. With four helicopters full of paparazzi circling overhead, on April 19, 1997, Brooke and I get married. The ceremony takes place in Monterey, in a tiny church that's stiflingly, criminally hot. I'd give anything for a puff of fresh air, but the windows must remain shut to block out the noise of the helicopters. The heat is one reason I break out in a sweat during the ceremony. The main reason, however, is that my body and nerves are shot. As the priest drones on, sweat drips from my brow, from my chin, from my ears. Everyone is looking. They're sweating too, but not like me. The jacket of my new Dunhill tuxedo is soaked. Even my shoes squish when I walk. They're also fitted with lifts, another non-negotiable demand from Brooke. She's nearly 6 feet tall, and she doesn't want to tower over me in our photos, so she's wearing old-fashioned pumps with minimal heels, and I'm wearing what feel like stilts. Before we leave the church, a decoy bride, a stand-in for Brooke, leaves first, to throw the paparazzi off the scent. The first time I heard about this plan, I tuned out, refused to pay attention. Now, as I see the Brooke lookalike leaving, I have a thought no man should have on his wedding day. I wish I were leaving too. I wish I had a decoy groom to take my place. A horse-drawn carriage is standing by to whisk Brooke and me to the reception at a ranch called Stone Pine. But first we have a short car ride to the carriage. I sit in the car beside Brooke, staring into my lap. I feel mortified about my attack of hysterical sweats. Brooke tells me it's okay. She's very sweet, but it's not okay. Nothing is okay. Into the reception we go, into a solid wall of noise. I see a whirling carousel of faces. Philly, Gil, JP, Brad, Slim, my parents. There are famous people I don't know, have never met, but vaguely recognize. Friends of Brooke, friends of friends, some friends from friends. I catch sight of Perry, my best man and the self-anointed wedding producer. He wears a Madonna headset so he can be in constant communication with the photographers and florists and caterers. He's so jacked up, so high-strung, he's making me more nervous, which I didn't think was possible. At the end of the night, Brooke and I stagger up to our bridal suite, which I've arranged to have filled with hundreds of candles. Too many candles. The room is an oven. It's hotter than the church. Again, I start to sweat. We start to blow out the candles, and the smoke detectors go off. We disable the smoke detectors and open the windows. While the room cools, we go downstairs, back to the reception, to spend our wedding night eating chocolate mousse with the wedding party. The following afternoon, at a barbecue for friends and family, Brooke and I make a grand entrance. As per Brooke's plan, we wear cowboy hats and denim shirts and arrive on horses. Mine is named Sugar. Her sad, glassy eyes remind me of Peaches. People surround me, talk at me, congratulate me, slap me on the back, and I need to run away. I spend a good portion of the barbecue with my nephew, Skyler, son of Rita and Poncho. We get hold of a bow and arrow and take target practice with a distant oak. While drawing back the bow, I feel a sudden twinge in my wrist. I pull out of the 1997 French Open. Of all the surfaces, clay is the worst on a tender wrist. There is no way I can last 5 sets against the dirt rats, who've been practicing and drilling on clay while I've been getting manicures and riding sugar. But I will go to Wimbledon. I want to go. Brooke has landed an acting job in England, which means she can accompany me. This will be good, I think. A change of venue. A trip, our first as husband and wife, to somewhere other than an island. Though, come to think of it, England is an island. In London, we spend several happy nights, dinner with friends, an experimental play, a walk along the Thames. The stars are lined up for a good Wimbledon. And then, I decide that I'd rather jump in the Thames. Out of nowhere, I can't bring myself to practice. I tell Brad and Gil I'm pulling out of the tournament. I'm in vapor lock. Brad says,
"What the hell does vapor lock mean?"
I've played this game for a lot of reasons, I say, and it just seems like none of them has ever been my own. The words come tumbling out with no forethought, just as they did that night with Slim. But they sound remarkably true. So much, in fact, that I write them down. I repeat them to reporters and to mirrors. After pulling out of the tournament, I stay on in London, waiting for Brooke to finish filming. We go out one night with a group of actors to a world-famous restaurant Brooke is eager to try, the Ivy. Brooke and the actors talk over each other while I silently hunker down at one end of the table, eating. Grazing, actually. I order 5 courses, and for dessert, I shovel 3 sticky toffee puddings into my mouth. Slowly, an actress notices how much food is disappearing at my end of the table. She looks at me, alarmed. "Do you always," she asks, "eat like this?" I'm playing in D.C., and my opponent is Flack. Brad tells me to go out and avenge last year's Wimbledon loss, but I can't imagine anything mattering less. Revenge? Again? Haven't we been down that road before? It makes me sad and weary that Brad can be so blinded by his Bradness, that he can be so oblivious to what I'm feeling. Who does he think he is? Brooke? I lose to Flack, of course, then tell Brad I'm shutting down for the summer. Brad says, "The whole summer?" "See you in the fall." Brooke is in Los Angeles, but I spend most of my time in Vegas. Slim is there, and we get high a lot. It's a welcome change to have energy, to feel happy, to clear away the vapor lock. I like feeling inspired again, even if the inspiration is chemically induced. I stay awake all night, several nights in a row, relishing the silence. No one phoning, no one faxing, no one bothering me. Nothing to do but dance around the house and fold laundry and think. "I want to get clear of the void," I tell Slim.
"Yeah," he says. "Yeah, the void."
Apart from the buzz of getting high, I get an undeniable satisfaction from harming myself and shortening my career. After decades of merely dabbling in masochism, I'm making it my mission. But the physical aftermath is hideous. After 2 days of being high, of not sleeping, I'm an alien. I have the audacity to wonder why I feel so rotten. I'm an athlete. My body should be able to handle this. Slim gets high all the time, and he seems fine. Then, all at once, Slim is not fine. He becomes unrecognizable, and drugs aren't fully to blame. He was always frantic about the prospect of becoming a father. Now he phones me one night from the hospital and says, "It happened."
"What?"
"She had the baby, months ahead of time. A boy. Andre, it only weighs 1 pound 6 ounces. The doctors don't know if he's going to make it." I speed down to Sunrise Hospital, the hospital where Slim and I were born 24 hours apart. I stare through the glass at what they tell me is a baby, though it's only the size of my open palm. The doctors tell Slim and me that the baby is very sick. They have to give him an IV of antibiotics. The next morning, the doctors tell us that the IV popped out. It dripped on the baby's leg, and now the leg is burned. Also, the baby's not breathing on his own. They need to put him on a ventilator. It's risky. The doctors worry that the baby's lungs aren't developed enough for the ventilator, but without the ventilator, he'll die. Slim says nothing. Do whatever you think best, I tell the doctors. As feared, hours later, one of the baby's lungs collapses, then the other. Now the doctors say the lungs really can't handle the ventilator, but without the ventilator, the baby will die. They simply don't know what to do. There's one final hope, a machine that might do the work of a ventilator without harming the lungs. A machine that takes the blood from the baby, oxygenates it, then flows it back into the baby. But the nearest such machine is in Phoenix. I arrange for a medical airplane. A team of doctors and nurses unhooks the baby from the ventilator and carries him like an egg to the tarmac. Then Slim, his girlfriend, and I board a separate plane. A nurse gives us a number to call when we land to find out if the baby has survived the flight. As the wheels touch down in Phoenix, I take a breath and dial. Is he? He made it, but now we need to get him onto the machine. At the hospital, we sit and sit. The clock doesn't move. Slim chain smokes. His girlfriend weeps quietly over a magazine. I step away for a moment to phone Gil. Casey isn't doing well, he says. She's in constant pain. He doesn't sound like Gil. He sounds like Slim. I return to the waiting room. A doctor appears, pulling down his mask. I don't know if I can handle more bad news. We managed to get him hooked to the machine, the doctor says. So far, so good. The next 6 months will tell. I rent a house near the hospital for Slim and his girlfriend. Then I fly back to Los Angeles. I should sleep on the flight, but instead I stare at the back of the seat in front of me and think how fragile it all is. The next 6 months will tell. To which of us does that dire statement not apply? At home, sitting in our kitchen, I tell Brooke the entire sad, awful, miraculous story. She's fascinated, but mystified. She asks, how could you get so involved? How could I not? Weeks later, Brad talks me into coming back, briefly, to play at the ATP Championships in Cincinnati. I face Gustavo Kuerten, a Brazilian. It takes him 46 minutes to beat me, my third first-round loss in a row. Gullickson announces that he's dropping me from the Davis Cup team. I'm one of the best American players ever, but I don't blame him. Who could blame him? At the 1997 U.S. Open, I'm unseated for the first time in 3 years. I'm wearing a peach shirt, and they can't keep them in stock at the concession stand. Astonishing. People still want to dress like me. People want to look like me. Have they taken a good look at me lately? I reach the round of 16 and play Rafter, who's having his breakout year. He reached the semis of the French Open, and he's my personal favorite to win this tournament. He's a great serve and volleyer, reminiscent of Pete, but I always thought Rafter and I made a better rivalry, aesthetically, because Rafter is more consistent. Pete can play a lousy 38 minutes, then one lights-out minute and win the set, whereas Rafter plays well all the time. He's 6'2", with a low center of gravity, and he can change direction like a sports car. He's one of the hardest guys on the tour to pass, and even harder to dislike. He's all class, win or lose, and today he wins. He gives me a gentlemanly handshake and a smile in which there is an unmistakable trace of pity. I'm playing Stuttgart in 10 days. I should lie low, rest, practice. But instead I need to go to North Carolina, a little town called Mount Pleasant, because of Brooke. She's tight with David Strickland, an actor on her new TV show, Suddenly Susan, and David's traveling to North Carolina to spend his birthday with family. Brooke wants us to tag along. She thinks it would do us good, hanging out in the country, breathing fresh air, and I can't think of a good reason to say no. Mount Pleasant is a quaint southern town, but I don't see any mount, and it's not all that pleasant. The Strickland house is comfortable, with old wood floors and soft beds, and a warm, enveloping smell of cinnamon and pie crust. But somewhat incongruously, it sits on a golf course, its back porch only 20 yards from one of the greens, so there's always someone in my peripheral vision lining up a putt. The lady of the house, Granny Strickland, is ample-bosomed, apple-cheeked, straight out of Mayberry, and she's forever standing at her stove, baking something or whipping up another batch of paella. Not exactly training food, but to be polite, I clean my plate and ask for seconds. Brooke seems to be in heaven, and part of me understands. The house is surrounded by rolling hills and ancient trees. The leaves have turned 9 different colors of orange, and she loves David. They have a special bond, a secret language of inside jokes and comic banter. Now and then, they slip into their characters from the show, doing a scene, then laughing themselves hoarse. Then they quickly explain what they've just done and said, trying to bring me up to speed, so I don't feel left out. But it's always too little, too late. I'm the third wheel, and I know it. At night, the temperature drops. The cool air has a piney, earthy scent that makes me sad. I stand on the back porch, looking at the stars, wondering what's wrong with me, why this setting has no power to charm me. I think about that moment so many years ago when Philly and I decided I was going to quit. When that call came for me to play here in North Carolina, the rest is history. Over and over, I ask myself, what if? I decide that I need to work. Work, as always, is the answer. After all, Stuttgart is only days off. It would be nice to win. I phone Brad, and he locates a tennis court an hour or so away. He also scrounges up a sparring partner, a young amateur who'd love nothing more than to hit with me each morning. I drive through the morning mist toward the Blue Ridge Mountains and meet the amateur. I thank him for taking the time, but he says the pleasure is all his. It will be my honor, Mr. Agassi. I feel virtuous. I'm getting my work done, even here in this remote outpost. And then we start hitting. At the higher altitude, the ball flies every which way, defying gravity. It's like playing in outer space. Hardly worth the effort. Then the young pro blows out his shoulder. I spend the next 2 days of our southern sojourn scarfing paella and brooding. When I grow so bored that I think I might bang my head against a pine tree, I walk out to the golf course and try to birdie the hole off the porch. At last, it's time for me to leave. I kiss Brooke goodbye, kiss Granny Strickland goodbye, and notice that both kisses have the same amount of passion. I fly to Miami to connect with a direct flight to Stuttgart. Walking up to the gate, who should I see but Pete? As always, Pete. He looks as if he's done nothing for the last month but practice, and when he wasn't practicing, he was lying on a cot in a bare cell, thinking about beating me. He's rested, focused, wholly undistracted. I've always thought the differences between Pete and me were overblown by sports writers. It seemed too convenient, too important for fans, and Nike, and the game, that Pete and I be polar opposites, the Yankees and Red Sox of tennis. The game's best server versus its best returner. The diffident Californian versus the brash Las Vegan. It all seemed like horseshit, or, to use Pete's favorite word, nonsense. But at this moment, making small talk at the gate, the gap between us appears genuinely, frighteningly wide, like the gap between good and bad. I've often told Brad that tennis plays too big a part in Pete's life and not a big enough part in mine, but Pete seems to have the proportions about right. Tennis is his job, and he does it with brio and dedication, while all my talk of maintaining a life outside tennis seems like just that, talk. Just a pretty way of rationalizing all my distractions. For the first time since I've known him, including the times he's beaten my brains out, I envy Pete's dullness. I wish I could emulate his spectacular lack of inspiration and his peculiar lack of need for inspiration. I lose to Martin in the first round of Stuttgart. Driving away from the stadium, Brad is in a mood I've never seen. He looks at me with astonishment and sadness and a rafter-like pity. As we pull up to the hotel, he asks me up to his room. He rummages in the minibar and extracts two bottles of beer. He doesn't glance at the labels. He doesn't care that they're German. When Brad drinks German beer without noticing or complaining, something is up. He's wearing jeans and a black turtleneck. He looks somber, severe, and older. I've aged him.
Andre, we've got a big decision to make, and we're going to make it before we leave this room tonight.
What's up, Brad?
We ain't continuing like this. You're better than this. At least you used to be better. You either need to quit or start over. But you can't go on embarrassing yourself like this.
What?
Let me finish. You have game left. At least I think you do. You can still win. Good things can happen. But you need a full overhaul. You need to go back to the beginning. You need to pull out of everything and regroup. I'm talking square one.
When Brad talks about pulling out of tournaments, I know it's serious.
Here's what you need to do, he says. You need to train like you haven't trained in years, hardcore. You need to get your body right, get your mind right, then start at the bottom. I'm talking challengers, against guys who never dreamed they'd get a chance to meet you, let alone play you.
He stops. He takes a long sip of beer. I say nothing. We've come to the crossroads. This is it. And it feels as if we've been headed there for months. Years. I stare out the window at the Stuttgart traffic. I hate tennis more than ever, but I hate myself more. I tell myself, so what if you hate tennis? Who cares? All those people out there, all those millions who hate what they do for a living, they do it anyway. Maybe doing what you hate, doing it well and cheerfully, is the point. So you hate tennis. Hate it all you want. You still need to respect it. And yourself. I say, okay, Brad. I'm not ready for it to be over. I'm all in. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it. Chapter 21. Change. Time to change, Andre. You can't go on like this. Change, change, change. I say this word to myself several times a day, every day, while buttering my morning toast, while brushing my teeth, less as a warning than as a soothing chant. Far from depressing me or shaming me, the idea that I must change completely from top to bottom brings me back to center. For once, I don't hear that nagging self-doubt that follows every personal resolution. I won't fail this time, I can't, because it's change now or change never. The idea of stagnating, of remaining this Andre for the rest of my life, that's what I find truly depressing and shameful. And yet, our best intentions are often thwarted by external forces, forces that we ourselves set in motion long ago. Decisions, especially bad ones, create their own kind of momentum, and momentum can be a bitch to stop, as every athlete knows. Even when we vow to change, even when we sorrow and atone for our mistakes, the momentum of our past keeps carrying us down the wrong road. Momentum rules the world. Momentum says, "Hold on, not so fast, I'm still running things here." As a friend likes to say, quoting an old Greek poem, "The minds of the everlasting gods are not changed suddenly." Weeks after Stuttgart, walking through LaGuardia Airport, I get a phone call. It's a man with a gruff voice, a voice of judgment and condemnation, a voice of authority. He says he's a doctor working with the ATP, I think what those letters stand for, Association of Tennis Professionals. There is doom in his voice, as if he's going to tell me I'm dying, and then that's exactly what he tells me. It was his job to test my urine sample from a recent tournament.
"It's my duty," he says, "to inform you that you failed the standard ATP drug test. The urine sample you submitted has been found to contain trace amounts of crystal methylene."
I fall onto a chair in the baggage claim area. I'm carrying a backpack, which I slip off my shoulder and drop to the ground.
"Mr. Agassi?"
"Yes, I'm here. So, what now?"
"Well, there is a process. You'll need to write a letter to the ATP, admitting your guilt or declaring your innocence."
"Uh-huh."
"Did you know there was a likelihood that this drug was in your system?"
"Yes. Yes, I knew."
"In that case, you'll need to explain in your letter how the drug got there."
"And then?"
"Your letter will be reviewed by a panel."
"And then?"
"If you knowingly ingested the drug, if you, as it were, plead guilty, you'll be disciplined, of course."
"How?" He reminds me that tennis has three classes of drug violation. Performance-enhancing drugs, of course, would constitute Class 1, he says, which would carry suspension for 2 years. However, he adds, crystal methylene is a clear case of Class 2, recreational drugs. I think recreation. Recreation. I say, "Meaning?"
3 months suspension.
"What do I do once I've written this letter?"
"I have an address for you. Have you got something to write on?"
I fish in my backpack for my notebook. He gives me the street, city, zip code, and I scribble it all down in a daze, with no intention of actually writing the letter. The doctor says a few more things, which I don't hear, and then I thank him and hang up. I stumble out of the airport and hail a cab. Driving into Manhattan, staring out the smudged window, I tell the back of the cab driver's head, "So much for change." I go straight to Brooks Brownstone. Luckily, she's in Los Angeles. I'd never be able to hide my emotions from her. I'd have to tell her everything, and I couldn't handle that right now. I fall onto the bed and immediately pass out. When I wake an hour later, I realize it was just a nightmare. What a relief. It takes several minutes to accept that, no, the phone call was real. The doctor was real. The meth, all too real. My name, my career, everything is now on the line, at a craps table where no one wins. Whatever I've achieved, whatever I've worked for, might soon mean nothing. Part of my discomfort with tennis has always been a nagging sense that it's meaningless. Now I'm about to learn the true meaning of meaninglessness. Serves me right. I lie awake until dawn, wondering what to do, whom to tell. I try to imagine how it will feel to be publicly shamed, not for my clothes or game, not for some marketing slogan someone hung on me, but for my utter stupidity, mine alone. I'll be an outcast. I'll be a cautionary tale. Still, though I'm in pain, during the next few days I don't panic. Not yet, not quite. I can't, because other more harrowing problems crowd in from all sides. People around me, people I love, are hurting. Doctors need to operate a second time on little Casey's neck. The first operation was clearly botched. I arranged for her to fly to Los Angeles to have the best care, but during her post-surgery recuperation period, she's immobilized again, lying on her back in a hospital bed, and she's suffering terribly. Unable to move her head, she says her scalp and skin burn. Also, her room is unspeakably hot, and she's like her father, she can't take heat. I kiss her cheek and tell her, "Don't worry, we'll fix it." I look at Gil. He's shrinking before my eyes. I run to the nearest appliance store and buy the biggest, baddest air conditioning unit they have. Gil and I install it in Casey's window. When I turn the knob up to max cool and press power, Gil and I clap hands and Casey smiles as the cold air pushes the bangs from her pretty round face. Next, I run to a toy store, the swimming section, and buy one of those tiny inner tubes for toddlers. I slide the inner tube under Casey, positioning her head in the center, then blow it up until it gently and gradually lifts her head without altering the angle of her neck. A look of pure relief and gratitude and joy washes over her face, and in this look, in this courageous little girl, I find the thing I've been seeking, the philosopher's stone that unites all the experiences, good and bad, of the last few years. Her suffering, her resilient smile in the face of that suffering, my part in easing her suffering, this is the reason for everything. How many times must I be shown? This is why we're here, to fight through the pain and, when possible, to relieve the pain of others. So simple, so hard to see. I turn to Gil, and he sees it all, and his cheeks are glistening with tears. Later, while Casey sleeps, while Gil pretends not to sleep in a corner, I sit in a hard-backed chair at her bedside, a legal pad in my lap, and write a letter to the ATP. It's a letter filled with lies interwoven with bits of truth. I acknowledge that the drugs were in my system, but I assert that I never knowingly took them. I say Slim, whom I've since fired, is a known drug user and that he often spikes his sodas with meth, which is true. Then I come to the central lie of the letter. I say that I recently drank accidentally from one of Slim's spiked sodas, unwittingly ingesting his drugs. I say that I felt poisoned, but thought the drugs would leave my system quickly. Apparently, they did not. I ask for understanding and leniency, and hastily sign it, sincerely. I sit with the letter on my lap, watching Casey's face. I feel ashamed, of course. I've always been a truthful person. When I lie, it's almost always unknowingly or to myself. But imagining the look on Casey's face as she learns that Uncle Andre is a drug user, banned 3 months from tennis, and then multiplying that look by a few million faces, I don't know what else to do but lie. I promise myself that at least this lie is the end of it. I'll send the letter, but I won't do anything more. I let my lawyers handle the rest. I won't go before any panel and lie to anyone's face. I'll never lie about this publicly. From here on, I'll leave it in the hands of fate and men in suits. If they can settle it privately, quietly, fine. If not, I'll live with what comes. Gil wakes. I fold the letter and step with him into the hallway. Under the fluorescent lights, he looks drawn, pale. He looks, I can't believe it, weak. I'd forgotten. It's in hospital hallways that we know what life is about. I put my arms around him and tell him I love him and that we'll get through this. He nods, thanks me, mumbles something incoherent. We stand in silence for the longest time. In his eyes, I can see his thoughts circling the abyss. Then he tries to distract himself. He needs to talk about something, anything, other than the fear and worry. He asks how it's going with me. I tell him that I've decided to recommit myself to tennis, start at the minor leagues, and work my way back. I tell him that Casey has inspired me, shown me the way. Gil says he wants to help. No, you've got your hands full.
Hey, stand on my shoulders, remember? Reach.
I can't believe he still has faith. I've given him so many reasons to doubt. I'm 27, the age when tennis players start to fade, and I'm talking about a second chance, and yet Gil doesn't frown, doesn't arch an eyebrow.
Let's throw down, he says. It's on.
We start from the beginning, as if I'm a teenager, as if I've never worked out, because that's how I look. I'm slow, fat, frail as a kitten. I haven't picked up a dumbbell in a year. The heaviest thing I've lifted is Casey's air conditioner. I need to rediscover my body, add gingerly and gradually to its strength. But first, we're in Gil's gym. I'm sitting on the free bench. He's leaning against the leg extension. I tell him what I've done to my body, the drugs. I tell him about the pending suspension. I can't ask him to lead me out of the depths unless he knows how deep I've fallen. He looks as crushed as he looked in his daughter's hospital room. To me, Gil has always resembled that statue of Atlas, but now he looks as if he literally shoulders the weight of the world, as if he's bench-pressing the problems of 6 billion. His voice chokes. I've never been so disgusted with myself. I tell him I'm done with drugs. I'll never touch them again, but it goes without saying. He knows this as well as I do. He clears his throat, thanks me for being honest, then pushes it all aside.
Where you've been, he says, doesn't matter. From now on, we're all about where you're going.
Where we're going, I say.
Right.
He draws up a plan. He outlines a proper diet, and no more Mr. Nice Guy, he says.
No more lapses, no more fast food, no more shortcuts. You'll even have to cut back on the booze, he says.
Above all, he's going to keep me on a strict schedule. Eat, exercise, lift, hit, at precise times of day. As part of my new ascetic lifestyle, I'll be seeing less of my wife. I wonder if she'll notice. I put in a fierce, rugged month with Gil, every bit as rugged as our mini boot camp in early 1995. And then I go to a challenger, the bottom of the pro tennis ladder. The winner's check is $3,500. The crowd is smaller than the crowd at a typical high school football game. The venue is UNLV, familiar territory for such an unfamiliar moment. As Gil and I pull into the parking lot, I think of how far I've come and how far I haven't. These are the same courts I played on when I was 7. This is where I came the day Gil quit his job to work with me. I stood right over there, outside his office, hopping on one foot because I was so excited about the road that lay before us. Now, just a 3-wood from that spot, I'm playing hackers and has-beens. In other words, my peers. A challenger is the definition of small time, and nowhere is this more evident than in the players' lounge. The pre-match meal is airplane food, rubber chicken, limp veggies, flat soda. Once upon a time, at Slams, I would walk up and down the endless buffet line, chatting with wine-hatted chefs while they made me feathery omelets and homemade pasta. All gone. The indignities don't stop there. As a challenger, there are fewer ball boys. It makes sense, since there are practically no balls. You get only 3 per match. On either side of your court are rows of courts with other matches taking place simultaneously. As you toss a ball to serve, you see the players to your left and right. You hear them arguing. They don't care if they're interrupting your concentration. Fuck you and your concentration. Now and then a ball comes dribbling past your feet from another court, and you hear, "A little help?" You need to stop whatever you're doing and throw the ball back. Now you're the ball boy. Again. You also operate your own scoreboard, manually. During the changeover, I flip the little plastic numbers, which feel like part of a children's game. Fans laugh and yell things. "How the mighty have fallen!"
"Image is everything, eh, buddy?"
A high-ranking official says publicly that Andre Agassi playing a challenger is like Bruce Springsteen playing a corner bar. So what's wrong with Springsteen playing a corner bar? I think it would be cool if Springsteen played a corner bar now and then. I'm ranked number 141 in the world, the lowest I've been ranked in my adult life, the lowest I've dreamed of being ranked. Sports writers say I'm humbled. They love saying this. They couldn't be more wrong. I was humbled in the hotel room with Brad. I was humbled smoking meth with Slim. Now, I'm just glad to be out here. Brad feels the same way. He doesn't find anything demeaning about the challenger. He's re-energized, rededicated, and I love him for it. He's excited for this challenger, coaching me as if we're at Wimbledon. He doesn't doubt that this is step one on the road all the way back to number one. Inevitably, I put his faith to the test right away. I'm a shadow of my former self. My legs and arms might be on the mend, but my mind is still grossly out of shape. I reach the final, and then my mind gives out. Shaking from the pressure, the strangeness, the ridicule from the stands, I lose. Brad is undiscouraged.
"Some technique will need relearning," he says.
"Shot selection, for instance. You need to retrain that muscle with which a tennis player decides in the heat of battle that this shot is the right one and that shot is the wrong one. You need to remember that it doesn't matter if you hit the best shot in the world, remember? If it's the wrong moment, it's the wrong shot."
Every shot is an educated guess, and I'm no longer educated. I'm as green as I was in juniors. It took me 22 years to discover my talent, to win my first slam, and only 2 years to lose it. 1 week after Vegas, I play a challenger in Burbank. The venue is a public park. Center court has a large tree on one side that casts a 20-foot shadow. I've played on thousands of courts in my career, and this is the sorriest one of all. In the distance, I hear kids playing kickball and dodgeball, cars backfiring, boomboxes blaring. The tournament runs through Thanksgiving weekend, and I reach the third round, which falls on Thanksgiving Day. Rather than eating turkey at home, I'm scuffling in a Burbank public park, ranked 120 spots lower than I was two Thanksgivings ago. Meanwhile, in Göteborg, Davis Cup is underway. Chang and Sampras versus Sweden. It's sad, but appropriate, that I'm not there. I don't belong there. I belong here, under the ridiculous courtside tree. Unless I can accept that I'm where I'm supposed to be, I'll never belong there again. Warming up before my match, I realize that I'm only 4 minutes from the studio where Brooke shoots Suddenly Susan, on which Perry is now a producer. The show has become a smash hit, and Brooke's busy, working 12 hours a day. Still, it seems odd that she doesn't pop over, watch a few points. Even when I get home, she doesn't ask about the match. Then again, I don't ask about Suddenly Susan either. We talk about things. We talk about nothing. The only time I break training is to meet with Perry and lay the groundwork for my charitable foundation. This is what we talked about 15 years ago, two idealistic teenagers with their mouths full of chipwitches. We wanted to reach a plateau from which we could give back, and we finally arrived. I've negotiated a long-term deal with Nike, which will pay me tens of millions over the next decade. I've bought my parents a house. I've taken care of everyone on my team. Now, I'm financially able to think larger, to widen my lens, and in 1997, though I've hit rock bottom, or because I've hit rock bottom, I'm ready. My primary concern is children at risk. Adults can always ask for help, but children are voiceless, powerless. So the first project my foundation undertakes is a shelter for abused and neglected children who've been placed in the protective custody of the courts. The shelter includes a cottage for medically fragile children and a makeshift school. Next, we launch a program to clothe 3,000 inner-city children each year, then a series of scholarships to UNLV, then a Boys and Girls Club. My foundation takes a 2,200-square-foot building that's falling apart and turns it into a 25,000-square-foot showplace with a computer lab, a cafeteria, a library, and tennis courts. Colin Powell speaks at the dedication. I spend many carefree hours at the new Boys and Girls Club, meeting children, listening to their stories. I take them onto the tennis court, teach them the proper grip, watch their eyes sparkle because they've never held a racket before. I sit with them in the computer room, where the demand for online time is so great that they stand in long lines, patiently waiting their turn. It shocks me, pains me, to see how resolved they are to learn. Other times, I simply station myself in the rec center of the Boys and Girls Club, playing ping pong with the children. I never walk into that rec center without thinking of the rec center at the Bolotary Academy, where I was so scared that first night, my back against the wall. The memory makes me want to adopt every scared child I see. One day in the rec center, I sit with Stan, the man who runs the Boys and Girls Club. I ask him, "What more can we do? How can we make a bigger difference in their lives?" Stan says, "You have to figure out a way to occupy more of their day. Otherwise, it's one step forward, two steps back. You really want to make a difference? You want to have a lasting impact? You need more of their day. In fact, you need all of their day." So in 1997, I huddle again with Perry and we hit on the idea of adding education to our work. Then we decide to make education our work. But how? We briefly consider opening a private school, but the bureaucratic and financial obstacles are too much. By chance, I catch a story on 60 Minutes about charter schools, and it's the eureka moment. Charter schools are partly state-funded, partly privately funded. The challenge is raising money, but the benefit is retaining full control. With a charter school, we could do things the way we want. We'd be free to build something unique, special, and if it works, it can spread like wildfire. It can be a model for charter schools around the nation. It can change education as we know it. I can't believe the irony. A 60 Minutes piece caused my father to send me away to break my heart. And now a 60 Minutes piece lights the way home, gives me the map to find my life's meaning, my mission. Perry and I resolved to build the best charter school in America. We resolved to hire the best teachers, pay them well, and hold them accountable for grades and test scores. We resolved to show the world what can be done when you set your standards outrageously high and open the purse strings. We shake on it. I'll give millions of my own money to launch the school, but we'll need to raise many more millions. We'll issue a $40 million bond, then pay it off by parlaying and trading on my fame. At last, my fame will have a purpose. All those famous people I've met at parties and through Brooke, I'll ask them to give their time and talent to my school, to visit the children, and to perform at an annual fundraiser, which we're calling the Grand Slam for Children. While Perry and I are scouting locations for our school, I get a call from Gary Muller, a South African who used to play and coach on the tour. He's organizing an event in Cape Town to raise money for the Nelson Mandela Foundation. He asks if I'd like to take part.
We don't know if Mandela's going to be there, he says.
If there's even a remote chance, I'm in. Gary calls right back.
Good news, he says. You're going to get to meet the man.
You're kidding.
He's confirmed. He's coming to the event.
I grip the phone tighter. I've admired Mandela for years. I've followed his struggles, his imprisonment, his miraculous release and stunning political career with awe. The idea of actually meeting him, speaking to him, makes me dizzy. I tell Brooke, it's the happiest she's seen me in a long time, which makes her happy. She wants to come. The event happens to be a short flight from where she stayed while filming her Africa movie back in 1993 when we first started faxing. She immediately goes shopping for matching safari outfits. JP shares my reverence for Mandela, so I invite him to join us on the trip and bring his wife, Joni, whom Brooke and I both love. The four of us fly to South America, then catch another plane to Johannesburg. Then we hop a rickety prop plane into the heart of Africa. A storm forces us to make an unscheduled landing. We batten down in a straw-roofed hut in the middle of nowhere, and over the sound of thunder, we can hear hundreds of animals run for cover. Looking out of the hut, over the vast savanna, watching storm clouds whirl along the horizon, JP and I agree this is one of those moments. We're both reading Mandela's memoir, Long Walk to Freedom, but feeling like heroes in a Hemingway novel. I think about something Mandela said once in an interview. No matter where you are in life, there is always more journey ahead. And I think of one of Mandela's favorite quotes from the poem Invictus, which sustained him during those moments when he thought his journey had been cut short. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.